It's a pleasure to be here, and let me get the chairs out because I always trip over the chair. That's inevitable. It's really an exciting opportunity that I am going to be discussing today. My goal is to convince you that, in fact, biomedical research is at a critical juncture, and you can contribute at this point. As we just heard, and thank you so much for inviting me to be here and for the generous introduction, it wasn't that long ago, about a dozen years ago, that we got our first glimpse at the human genome. As many of you know, there were two competing teams, one from the private sector, Celera, headed with informatics headed by Gene Myers, and another one from the public. And Jim Kent, a graduate student in my lab, actually stepped up at the last minute to solve one of the most difficult computational problems, and that's putting together the small pieces of DNA that come off the DNA sequencing machines into a coherent picture of the human genome. Our first picture of the human genome, which was posted on the internet on July 7th, 2000. And I like this picture because this green represents the total outgoing internet traffic from the University of California Santa Cruz campus. And so when it hit the web that the human genome was on there and anybody could download it, we had a half a terabyte of activity there, all of a sudden spiking and eclipsing all previous records. Since then, there has been an unbelievable and unprecedented dramatic improvement in DNA sequencing technology. Basically, DNA sequencing technology today is killing Moore's Law. And these are the stats here. You see Moore's Law, improvement of a factor of 2 every 2 years during this time period from about 01 to 2011. This is DNA sequencing technology. And you can see this curve changes radically with the introduction of new technology a few years ago. In the last 8 years, we've been improving DNA sequencing technology by a factor of 10 every 2 years. That's a 10,000-fold improvement over this period when computer technology improved by a factor of 16. So we have a mismatch between our capability to sequence DNA today and our capability to analyze it, and that's the primary reason that I'm here talking to you. You are going to be called into action at this point to help with this critical situation. So what does it mean for the price of a genome to drop from more than $100 million to $1,000 next year? It means that we no longer think about looking at the one reference human genome, but we think about looking at all of our genomes. Personal genomics is the new wave of medicine, and it will be very powerful if we can interpret this DNA information. What will lead that wave of personal genomics will be cancer research. And there are a number of reasons for this that I outlined here. In fact, of course, cancer has a very high rate of mortality. Half the men in this room will face cancer in their lifetime, a third of the women. It is widespread and very, very critical. There's probably no one in this room that doesn't know someone who has been affected by this disease. The other part of this is that it is caused by changes to the DNA. That mutations in some of the cells in your body that cause them to grow in an uncontrolled fashion are what causes cancer. There's no question that it is a genetic disease. Many of these genes that are mutated and cause cancer are now targeted by new drugs, not chemotherapy or radiation therapy, the traditional mechanisms for treating cancer, but new drugs. So we hope to be able to understand the genetics of cancer in order to apply these drugs. In many cases, the medical establishment is quite resistant and slow to change, but in cancer, there actually is a willingness to try new ideas. When patients have failed standard of care, there are a lot of new ideas being tried. And finally, you may have heard a lot, and I don't want to say anything negative about personal genomics, but there are companies that say, well, sequence your genome and we'll tell you all about your health. A lot of that information you can't do anything about at this stage. Some of it you can, and I do highly advocate that. But the problem is, if I know that something's wrong in your genome, which is in every cell in your body, and I want to fix it, that's a very hard thing to do. Whereas cancer is a few rogue cells, well, billions, but they're all controlled, they're all concentrated in a tumor, and we don't have to fix them, we just have to kill them. So it's not that it's easy for us to do this, but it's plausible that within a decade we'll be able to do it a lot better than we can now. Here is a classic example. This is a picture from the trials that were conducted by Roche Pharmaceuticals a few years ago when they first tried this new targeted therapy. Verumafenib is a drug that is specifically targeted to cells that contain a particular mutation in a gene called BRAF, the so-called V600 mutation in BRAF, which occurs repeatedly in melanoma and other diseases. This patient suffers from metastatic melanoma. You can see lesions, essentially metastatic tumors growing all over his body. He gets this new therapy which kills any cell which contains that mutation. 15 weeks later, the guy is swimming, working out in the gym. Unprecedented actual progress, and it shocked the hell out of the researchers that actually developed the drug in the first place. Now, I want to sober you up. Unfortunately, that's what the patient looked like after 23 weeks of therapy, and he died shortly thereafter. So cancer is not going to be easy to defeat, but we have a new avenue into it. What happened here is, if you look at it, you can actually map the old tumors to the new tumors. Each one of those tumors is billions of cells. All it takes is one of those cells that's resistant to the therapy to grow out and repopulate the tumor. It may be different mechanisms of resistance in these different tumors. We don't understand exactly what happened in this patient because they didn't sequence the tumors. But now we have to go in and look at the DNA changes and actually study all of those mutations and understand how we can defeat the disease and how we can respond when it strikes back. So what we're talking about is a database of cancer genomes. This is a database that will be deployed nationally and linked with other international databases. You can imagine its use in clinical practice and research. The patient comes in, gets their cancer genome sequenced. It's compared to 1,000 and soon 1,000,000, if we can muster the right forces, of different genomes, similar genomes that have occurred in the past, because the one thing about cancer is the same mutations are repeated again and again. And so we are all a very life-threatening experiment of nature, unfortunately, at this point. It's happening in our bodies every day, and we need to learn from the past. We need to record this information, and we need to have intensive computational analysis of that so the patient's genome can be compared to the genomes in this database and advise treatment. Right now, the largest cancer genome sequencing project in the world is the Cancer Genome Atlas program that is being conducted by the National Institute of Health, in particular by the National Cancer Institute, which is within the National Institute of Health. And as you can see, there are a lot of centers that are participating in this and various aspects of it. Biospecimens that are collected from patients, DNA sequencing centers that sequence the DNA, analysis centers that analyze it, and data centers that store it. The data center that we'll talk about is CG Hub, and what it stores is the raw DNA information. So I want to take you on a little bit of tour about what the data look like and how they are obtained. From each patient in the TCJ and from the other major cancer genome sequencing projects worldwide, we get a biopsy from the tumor. Those cells are subjected to DNA extraction and sequenced on a sequencing machine, which literally produces billions of short reads of DNA. At the same time, DNA from normal tissue in the patient is obtained, and that is sequenced. What we're interested in is, what is the difference between the DNA in the tumor and the DNA in the normal tissue in the patient? Because it's those changes, those mutations, that are driving the cancer. All of these short reads of DNA are matched to the reference genome. So the reference genome that we spoke about, which has been on the web now for a dozen years, is represented abstractly as this green line. And the DNA is actually chopped up into pieces that are about 300 to 400 base pairs of DNA long. And we sequence 100 bases from each end. So that's why you have these little diagrams here. What we're actually sequencing are the boxes. And this represents the unsequenced part of the DNA between the two ends of the piece. Now, 100 bases of DNA is plenty, normally, to be a unique piece of the reference genome. So we can often map it directly to a place in the human genome, and we get data that looks like mapped paired reads. That's what you see here. Now, if there is a particular difference between that patient's DNA and the reference human genome, we will see it as an A showing up in these reads where normally there's a T or some other similar change. And we can see in the blue, these represent the reads from the germline, and in the red from the tumor, we can see in this case that both the tumor and the regular tissue from this person have a change. That's not surprising. We all have about 3 or 4 million differences from each other, so there are differences in our DNA, we're not genetically identical. And of course, the tumor is just a variant of your normal genome. So this would be called a germline variant. It's a variant that you inherited from your parents. It may contribute to cancer, but we find that the majority of changes that make a cancer, are just changes in the tumor cell. Here's an example of one. Now, I want you to imagine that these reads are about 30-fold to 60-fold deep. I didn't have time to show it, but we read every position in the genome in the future, currently about 30 times, in the future about 60 times. And so we would see, we would hope to see many, many cases in which the mutant occurs in the tumor DNA and not in the normal DNA of the patient. And we would call that a somatic change or a somatic mutation in a cell. Now, it's interesting that we can not only detect point mutations, where a single base of DNA changes from one form to the other, but we can detect structural changes. So it turns out that the DNA gets changed in other ways. Here, in fact, we have something that was inherited in the germline and is in the tumor. So this is, you see, both blue and red. And this represents a deletion. So whereas there's a normal piece of DNA, so this piece of DNA occurs in the reference genome and occurs in most people, that piece of DNA is missing in the patient, and it was missing from birth, is what we're saying here. So that's an important piece of information, a deletion. You can also have a tandem duplication. In this case, the DNA read continues back here, so we essentially go and read this piece of DNA twice. And that happens only in the tumor. You see only red here, so we have a tandem duplication in the tumor. The other thing you can have is an inversion, and you can go through the logic of detecting a piece of DNA that's inverted in the tumor. That can also cause cancer. All of these data are stored in a file format called BAM. And that format stores the data from a single patient in approximately 100 gigabytes when compressed, as far down as we can compress it without losing important information at this point. So these are large files, 100 gigabyte of pop. From that, we derive a file called VCF, variant call format, which is the interpretation of that file. I'll return to that later. All of these files from the National Cancer Institute's genome projects, which include both the Cancer Genome Atlas and the Target Project, which concentrates specifically on childhood cancers, go into the Cancer Genomics Hub. It's designed to hold 50,000 genomes, and at 100 gigabytes each, that's 5 petabytes, which is, for you big data people, I mean, that's not the biggest database you've ever heard of, but for biology, this is big. It's comparable to Large Hadron Collider, you know, other kind of big scientific databases. Currently, there are 24,000 files representing about 5,000 cases, and we've had 2 petabytes of data downloaded so far. You can download the data, and I encourage you to Google Cancer Genomics Hub and go there. It's all automated API. You can download using the GeneTorrent software, which is an open source software and get your 100 gigabytes per genome. The total cost of this project is small compared to the cost of cancer care and cancer research. We are estimating the cost at about $100 per year per genome because we have to refresh the technology all the time when we reach 50K genomes, and we're not quite there yet. About $5 million a year, and the technology costs about half the total. What's important, though, for you and for this community is that so far the government has not paid for cloud computing resources associated with the data. So they've paid to store the data, but then once you get the data and downloaded it, you're on your own. And we and also the NCI wants to change that, and so there will be a lot of discussion about a new mechanism. First, we need to think about scaling up not to 1,000 genomes or 50,000 genomes, but to 1 million genomes. There are 1.6 million new cases of cancer every year in the United States alone. That data, the molecular information in each of those tumors, is sitting on the shelf or going down the drain at this point. We have to obtain that information not only to treat these patients better, but for research. I'm working with Dave Patterson, many of you may know Dave Patterson from UC Berkeley. He's absolutely a fantastic individual to work with in terms of design, and he has laid out his idea of what this million genome cancer database would look like. That's exactly what we need to attack the full complexity of cancer, and I'll be showing you details about why the mutation pattern in cancer is so complicated. His estimate in 2014 dollars would be $25 per year per genome, a substantial reduction, but that's just for the technology, so maybe $50 for everything. But his design includes cloud compute at the data, and of course, all of you big data people know why that's so important. It's ridiculous to be sending these enormous files over the optical fiber in the US. Once we get to 1 million genomes, people have to bring their computation to the data. We could think about this as a private cloud or use a vendor like Amazon or do it with Google. All of these are possible. The data would be replicated necessarily at least two different centers, but we do not want a proliferation of hundreds and hundreds of centers. And if we don't step in and provide this alternative, that is the natural way in which things go. Every medical center right now wants to build their own cancer genome database for their data and not share. I hate to tell you the bad news, but not everybody is, you know, on board with this, right? So we have to show them how an open source and a high-level organized project like this would be better than having all the data siloed off in individual medical centers. If we can do this, it would be a primary storage for clinical genomes. There's no way we're going to get 1 million cancer genomes just for research purposes only. It will have to be, and it will have to be for and serve the clinical community, which means there will have to be two different interfaces, one for research and one for clinical storage of cancer genomes. Right now, it is not a part of standard practice to get your genome sequenced, and that will change in 5 years. A lot of possible sources for revenue. We needed to have a platform in which the best minds, many of which are sitting in this audience right now, can build the top software. So everybody does this. Of course, Apple made a great splash with this. Everybody says this, but it's true. We absolutely want a platform that supports apps. Now, are there any apps? Well, we produced a browser 12 years ago for the reference human genome, and we're trying to extend that so that you can look at personal genomics information on the browser, and it does have extensive use. We do get a large number, 3 million page requests per week, and that can give you all kinds of information. This is very much designed for the expert researcher, so it's got all kinds of subtle biological information about all the locations in the reference genome. Another very flexible tool, and I highly recommend this, Penn State has developed the Galaxy program, in which it actually contains a list. The tool shed is just packed with bioinformatics tools that people have donated into the system, contributed to the system, and it allows you to build a little pipeline which says, I take this file, I apply this tool, and the output goes here, and then I apply this other tool, and you can reuse those pipelines. And so it's a great community resource. I highly recommend Galaxy. There's a browser out of the Broad Institute, which is one of the leading analysis institutes that allows you to look at the reads in the context of the reference genome from your cancer, the IGV. There's a, out of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, there's another great portal called cBio. And then there's the UCSC Cancer Genomics Browser, which is specifically now oriented not towards the reference genome, but for to look at 100 or 200 cases of a particular subtype of cancer and then do statistical tests to find out what is common to these 100 cases of cancer that distinguishes them from other. So I want to talk a little bit about, well, what just happened here? PowerPoint quit unexpectedly. That certainly was unexpected. Let's just see, recovered file one. What do we just do, huh? Go with it. So I want to switch, it's an interesting transition here, because I do want to switch into giving you a glimpse a little bit at the issues and kind of under the hood. And in order to do that, I'm going to give you, like a direct look at the data. But what the slide that blew the PowerPoint up was saying was that, in fact, there are two types of problems. One is I give one person's personal genome and you're supposed to interpret it. The other is that you have a database with thousands or millions of genomes and you're supposed to search that for patterns that are common and associated with certain kinds of disease attributes or clinical response. So both of these are incredibly important types of problems that are distinct, and you can contribute software for this if you get into this area. The first thing that we have here is how do we take the reads that we showed diagrammatically earlier, those little 100 base ends of 300 long pieces of DNA, and actually interpret what the mutations are? Well, all of those reads are stored in this file called the BAM file. And they're actually mapped to the reference genome in that file. And so any group can pick up those reads, and you can ask a simple question. For every position in the reference genome, is there a change that occurs just in the tumor? Is there a change, like where an A is changed to a G at a certain position in the chromosome? List those changes. Very, very simple thing. You would think that would be a highly solved problem. We took the very same data from a set of tumors. This is one tumor that you see here. And we ran it through the pipeline at the Broad Institute, our pipeline, and the pipeline at Washington University, St. Louis. These two, I would say, the Broad and Washington University, are the leading cancer genome analysis groups in the world at this time, in my opinion. And the good news is that all three groups agreed on about 2,000. The bad news, as this Venn diagram shows, is that there were a lot of positions where we disagreed. So it turns out that just the act of reading the data is not something that hardened software exists for today. The other part about this is that this software is too inefficient. It takes a week to do this, and it's got to take hours. So we have a number of challenges here, and I want to advertise one thing here. If you go to CG Hub, if you Google CG Hub right now, we just posted last week some data which will form the nucleus of a challenge. We call it a benchmark. So there's lots of data there that you can download and try, if you will, to write an algorithm to make this prediction. We're going to announce a bake-off in a couple of weeks that will be an international thing. So that's very important that we standardize. In this bake-off, we also challenge you to recognize structural changes. So this is what you will be looking at here. These are so-called circle diagrams. And here, the reference human genome is organized like a clock, chromosome 1, chromosome 2, and so forth around the reference human genome. And these lines, arcs that you see here, represent instances where, in this case, a piece of chromosome 9, a DNA on chromosome 9, chromosome 1, is abnormally connected to DNA on chromosome 9. This is an abnormal change in the tumor where the chromosomes have literally been cut and pasted together in an unusual fashion. To recognize these structural changes is even more challenging, and you can see some of the stats on here on how we agree. The interesting thing about these structural changes is that you can often actually narrow them down to the individual base pair. So here's an example. These are actual DNA reads from an actual ovarian tumor, OV0751. These DNA sequences, the red part is matching to the reference genome at around chromosome 2, 29,000, blah, 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 and the blue part is matching at 28,500, blah, blah, blah. So diagrammatically, this read starts here and then loops back and continues back here 500,000 bases earlier in the reference genome. Not only that, but this plot that you see here represents just simply the number of reads that match to this position, and you'll see that there are extra reads that match in this 500,000 base region. So given combining those two pieces of information, you should come to the conclusion that this piece is tandemly duplicated. In other words, there are two copies of that region in the tumor, whereas there's only one in normal genome. Here's another example, in which case we would not have noticed from the read depth that there's an extra copy, but this loopback indicates a copy of 16,682 base pairs that's tandemly duplicated. And again, with the precision of DNA, we can map that precisely to the base. These structural changes are extremely important in cancer. This is a study now moving from ovarian cancer to glioblastoma or brain cancer, in which we looked at the DNA from 16 different tumors, and we found that in 11 of them, there was a similar deletion. So the endpoints of the deletion were never the same, but the effect of the deletion was that it deleted a gene called CDKN2AB. That gene turns out to be what's called a tumor suppressor. It's a very, very important gene. It's like the brakes. It allows you to control the growth of the cell. If you lose the brakes, then you are subject to cancer, and you have to lose both copies of it. There's a redundancy in our genomes that you're familiar with. You get one copy of each gene from mom and one copy from dad, and so you have two copies. In a case like this, unless you knock out both copies, you're okay. Well, that's exactly what happened in the cancer, and it happened in two separate processes. We can see that there was a focal loss of one of the genes, and in the other case, a complete loss of an entire chromosome arm in some cases. One of these was things called a complex event. So to give you a little more flavor for some of the things that have been discovered now that we're actually looking at cancer genomes, here's a case where we were looking at two genes here that got fused by an abnormal rearrangement of the DNA. And that fusion event, we tried to interpret that in isolation, and it didn't make any sense. So it turns out that, in fact, that fusion event, which is shown right here, is part of a very, very complicated set of events. Each one of these colored lines is a place where we detect with our genome reads that the chromosomes in the tumor have been cut and repasted together in an abnormal fashion. This is called chromothripsis. So it turns out that abstractly what's going on, oh, and then there's some nasty genes here. MDM2 is the loss of MDM2, or the amplification of MDM2, drives the cancer forward. What's actually happening in this chromothripsis event is that a region of a chromosome, or sometimes two chromosomes, are being shattered into hundreds of pieces. The cellular process for gluing DNA back together again comes up and glues the DNA back, glues the ends of this back together, but it has no idea what the order should be. And so it repairs this chromosome with a random set of these pieces, and it can create a circular additional chromosome just at random. If you can imagine sticking the ends together at random. You're going to create a circle just by chance sometimes. Those pieces of mutated chromosomes can be a big part in cancer. When the process is this complicated, it takes mathematics and algorithms to analyze it. Here's a simple case where the raw data is shown in the upper left here. And you can see some connectivity here that's abnormal. If you map it, again, the green represents the reference human genome, you see that the chromosomes have been broken in four places. Each place you break the chromosome, you get two free ends, and then they get pasted back together again. And if you walk that, you can see how they've been pasted back together in an abnormal fashion. And if you look down here, you'll see that this agrees, this new walk of this region skips segment 3, and you can see that, in fact, the copy number of segment 3 is abnormally low, which is independent evidence that this walk may be the correct walk. You can go to our genome browser and see that this whole collection of genes has, in fact, been rearranged, mainly inverted, and this piece has been left out, which contains one of the genes. The mathematics I'm not going to go into, but there are data structures that represent the connectivity of the ends of pieces in the reference genome, the connectivity of the ends of pieces in the tumor. Those two things get compared to each other in a data structure called a breakpoint graph, and then we can do analysis on that breakpoint graph to try to understand the topological structure of the DNA in the tumor. So it's a great algorithmic problem. Here it is applied to a larger piece of data, and in fact now we're going back to this chromothripsis event that I just showed you. What a complicated mess it was. The fallout from that was that in fact two circular pieces of DNA were created, and we've completely reconstructed them here. The walk along the ends is shown diagrammatically here. Now what's important about this for the cancer is that one of those contains this gene MDM2. That I mentioned before, and amplifying MDM2 is a very bad thing. MDM2 inhibits p53, which is one of the tumor suppressor genes. It's probably the most important tumor suppressor gene. Keeping your p53 working is the most important thing you need to do to keep cells from going cancerous. But if you amplify MDM2, that inhibits p53. You've got too much inhibitor, p53 is shut down, and you can get cancer. So not only did this patient, again, this is a glioblastoma patient, a brain cancer patient, not only does this patient create this circular piece of DNA, but they've got 40 copies per cell. So it's the amplification of that which is so bad. Here's the other GBM case that we analyzed, and interestingly enough, again, MDM2 is part of the thing. The breakpoints, the exact breakpoints, are completely different. It's all random. Remember, what we're seeing is the unlucky events out of trillions of tries. Every cell in your body at all times during your lifetime is subject to mutations. We're very selectively seeing the ones that led to cancer. So this may seem absolutely, completely, astronomically low odds. Why would the same cuts be the same thing again and again? But if you try something a trillion times, bad shit will happen again. Okay, I want to say a little bit about what we do in a little bit more detail here. So we understand the topology, the structure of the DNA within the cancer genome. We can also look at the normal genome. And remember I said you got about 3-4 million differences. So it turns out that you got two copies, and so there are once every 1,000 bases or so in your genome, the letter that you got from dad is different from the letter you got from mom. This is called a heterozygous position. So you have two different versions there. So that can help us separate out the two different chromosomes that you have, and we essentially name them. We don't know which one came from mom and which one came from dad, but we name the one. We can say of those two variants, how often do we see them in the tumor DNA. So these are the two variants, the blue and the red variant, that we see at these positions in the regular DNA from the normal tissue in the patient, and this is how often we see it from the tumor. And not seeing the blue variant in this whole region suggests that there was a deletion. There's a little bit of bleed over here because not every tumor sample is completely purely tumor. Some of it will have normal cells with it as well. So based on that, we call one allele the majority allele and one allele the minority allele. Allele just is a DNA variant. And so we can calculate in each case how many copies of the minority allele, or the rare version in the tumor, are there, and how many copies of the majority allele are there. So we essentially break the whole cancer genome up into little pieces of DNA, about 100,000 bases each out of 3 billion total bases. And for each of those pieces of DNA, we analyze the two different versions of it, and we give you the overall copy number, which is the sum of the copies from both types, and the minority copy number. And so each one of these dots represents a piece of 100,000 bases that was taken out of the tumor. It's colored according to the chromosome that it came from. So this is like a scatter plot indicating the copy number variation throughout the tumor. Now, this region represents normal diploid DNA, two copies, one minority copy and two overall copies. So if I did the normal tissue, virtually all of the data would lie in a Gaussian distribution like you see around this point. In the tumor, we have abnormal things happening. In particular, one of the copies has been duplicated. And so we have total copy number 3 and minority copy number 1 in this case. And then we also have this curious case here where we have overall copy number 2, but the minority copy number is absent. So the tumor has done a very strange thing here. It's gotten rid of one of the copies, say the copy from mom, and it's duplicated the copy from dad. So you're back to two copies, and cells like to have two copies of stuff, which is one of the reasons that we're seeing this. But you got both copies from dad. Now, if there was a mutation on dad's chromosome at that point, now you've got two mutant copies and zero good copies. And this happens a lot. It's called copy-neutral loss of heterozygosity. Here's another one. This is an ovarian cancer this time. And you can see, again, that we can essentially make this grid. And the data are noisy versions of this digital data, which are telling us how many copies there are. So we can actually go back and take this rough plot here and make it sharp to say, well, there's actually exactly two copies here, exactly one copy here, and so forth, by using this grid analysis. Now, this means that essentially all cells in the tumor contain the same genome. That's not always the case. And in fact, about 50% of the time, we see evidence of subclonal variation. In fact, what we're seeing here is that data is showing things off-grid. This is, in fact, the glioblastoma that we saw earlier with the chromothripsis event and the fancy circular chromosomes. This thing has lost both copies of CDK and 2AB, as we said before. So we have zero overall copy number, zero minority copy number for that region of the genome. It's gotten some other mutations that you see here, but there are also things off-grid. So 63% of the cells have some variant, abnormal variant on chromosome 6, arm P. How can you get such a fractional number for various regions? This is a diagram that allows us to understand a little bit how tumors can be more complicated. You start out with a cell in the body. All of your cells are getting mutations all the time. So by the time you're old, like some of us, you know, there's a lot of mutations in these cells. Luckily, most of those mutations don't make any difference. They're called passenger mutations. They just accumulate. They don't really interrupt or change the cell's behavior at all. At some point, though, you get an initiating event called a driver event. So this is a mutation like loss of CDKN2A or loss of P53 or amplification of MDM2 that starts the tumor growing. Now, as the tumor grows, the cells get new mutations. And so a clone, you know, everybody knows the sci-fi version of a clone. It's always a guy that comes out of out of a vat of liquid, you know, completely adult. But a real clone is actually a cell culture phenomenon, right? It's a copy of a cell. And that that thing is happening inside the tumor. And so when you get a new driver event, each of these different colored regions represents a new clone or a new version of the cancer genome. And it's like Darwinian competition, essentially. They're competing to see who can grow the fastest. And the fastest growing, most aggressive version wins and takes over the tumor. But at any given point, like here, you take a snapshot, you're going to see the dark clone, you're going to see some of these lighter clones, and so you might see a mixture. And in the particular tumor we were just looking at, you see approximately 63% is one clone and 37% is another clone. So there's two clones duking it out. And it's important to understand that subclonal variation. So Daniel Zerbino, I hope you've been seeing some of the names here. I haven't been reading them out. We'll go back to them at the end. But Daniel Zerbino in my group is working for a long time on a complicated piece of software that does what we just said. It takes the raw copy number information. It flattens it out by removing noise. It estimates the total copy number changes. It looks at the rearrangements and saying that this piece of DNA is connected to this piece of DNA abnormally and so forth. And based on all of that information, it comes up with actually a Monte Carlo model, which you can run many, many times for what actually happened in the tumor. And in this case, one run is saying that there was a duplication of this segment causing this peak, then a duplication of this segment causing this peak, then a loss causing this dip. Why do we care about? We care about the exact events. Obviously, we want to reconstruct what the tumor is, but we also want to know how it got there. So we want to be able to reconstruct the clonal evolution. We care about early events because they're more likely to be driver events. You can run this. This is what happens on the chromothripsis. You can see that he is saying, indeed, that these weren't a bunch of independent events, but they all happened at once in a very complicated rearrangement that he predicts to have happened early on in cancer progression. So this is an idea of the kind of the complexity it takes. So we are a far cry from doing this, but one challenge to you very concretely is download the data at CG Hub in Benchmark 4, which will be announced in a couple weeks, and try to predict these mutations from the raw data. If you can do it better than anybody else, you will have made a serious contribution to cancer research. So challenge number one. Challenge number two is, suppose I tell you exactly what's in the tumor. Suppose we could read it without any error. I tell you exactly the status of every base in the tumor. Can you interpret that? What do you tell the doc to do at that point? That's even huger as a problem. So we have a serious gap in our understanding of tumors, and trying to understand how genomes work is a very, very fundamental thing that we need to do. So I'm going to talk about a little bit of work. So this was in the first Cancer Genome Atlas paper, which was on brain cancer. They did a statistical analysis of all the mutations that were found in several hundred brain cancers, and they just looked at the genes that were altered by those mutations, and they made charts. And they compared those charts to what was known in the biology literature, which genes talk to other genes. So for example, the gene MDM2 that we talked about before inhibits P53. So this little T-shaped thing means inhibits. And an arrow means that it enhances. So genes can be connected to each other in a very crude way. They either, one gene inhibits another gene or it enhances another gene, so activates another gene. And so if you just use those simple notations, we can see that these genes inhibit these genes inhibit this gene, and that gene inhibits this gene. It's crazy about the inhibitory logic of the cell is really crazy. Now, and then they plotted red, meaning that it's overly active, amplified or something, and blue to mean that it's under-amplified. And so if you look at any one of these data points, like this one, MDM4, is amplified in 77% of the cases. That's not statistically significant by itself. This guy's amplified in 1% of the cases, not statistically significant. But if you look at this entire the logic of this entire pathway of interactions, you see a pattern. Not only is there a lot of mutation, but logically, this is cell cycle progression. So this is something that is going to cause, if you inhibit RB1, it's going to cause the cells to multiply in an uncontrolled fashion. And lo and behold, we see evidence that this gene is inhibited 10% of the time, 11% of the time. Likewise, if you amplify something that inhibits this inhibitor, then that will have the same effect. And we see amplification at this layer. Or you can inhibit an inhibitor of the inhibitor of the inhibitor. So the logic follows consistently through. We have a logic diagram here, and it's always being perturbed in the nasty way that will make the cells grow uncontrolled. That is a sign that these changes are important to the cancer. And there's a similar logic in the other diagrams here. So by combining the data from lots of cases and knowing the different logic of the cell, we can make more informed guesses as to what's going on. What does that mean for you computer geeks? You need a machine-readable format of biology. So the best we have are these databases. These are actual file formats that have information that describes how this gene inhibits this other gene, etc. So many groups internationally now are trying to use those to interpret cancer data. This is the Josh Stewart group. So typically, in one of those files, we will have this link that I just talked about. MDM2 inhibits P53. That has to be recorded in a data structure and then used in an actual probabilistic model. And I think many of you are familiar with some of these models. So we need a gene-level model that describes the activity and status of each gene. And we need an interaction model that describes the status of this connection between genes. So the Josh Stewart group at UCSC has proposed this model. There are other models out there, but this is a great one, where there are four hidden states for each gene that follow the so-called central dogma of molecular biology. First off, you can ask yourself, how many copies of this gene are in the DNA? We have to estimate that from data. We can read that from various chips or DNA sequencing, as I just described. So this is actual data. And then there's an interaction link here. This is a Bayesian net. It's a factor graph, actually. And there's a strength of interaction that interprets this data and estimates this hidden state. If I know then how many copies, I'm going to care about how many mRNA or messenger RNA expression transcripts are being made. So the more a gene makes RNA, the more it will be expressed in the cell. This is the central dogma. DNA makes RNA, makes protein. So at every step through this, we have a hidden state where we can infer the level of messenger RNA, the level of protein, and then the level of activated protein. So there are more biochemical reactions that can activate a protein. And if we have estimates of these four hidden states, which we get from data, then we can know, essentially, or infer, I should say, the status of every one of the 20,000 genes in the cancer tissue. In this case that we're looking at, we have evidence here, red, that MDM2 has 40 copies in the DNA, in that little circular piece of DNA. Therefore, we infer that there are lots of copies in the DNA that are creating lots of messenger RNA, that are creating lots of protein that's becoming activated. And that activation, this link is represented in the network to a similar model for TP53. And that inhibits the conversion of the messenger RNA to protein. Therefore, we have less in blue. Red is over too much. Blue is not enough. We have not enough P53, not enough active protein. And therefore, the cell is out of control. Apoptosis is programmed death. Most of you are not getting cancer. Most of us are not getting cancer because our body takes care of it ourselves. Usually when a cell goes rogue, it commits suicide. If that process is inhibited, you're in trouble. So here's how we use this. We take all of this raw information and infer activity levels of all of the genes in all of the known biological pathways. So here is a set of, each row is a gene or process in a pathway like apoptosis. And each column is a patient sample. And the red and the blue are the inferred activity levels. Red means way too active, and blue means not active enough. Each one of these patients shows a very strong pattern of activity for a few dozen different genes that are all closely related. It turns out that that's the FOXM1 transcription network. These are the genes that are involved in that network. And red, in each one of the spokes is a different patient. Red means overactive in that patient. So you can see this entire cluster of genes is overactive in this patient. This is ovarian cancer data, as it says. And in fact, some of these are targetable. The polo-like kinase gene and the Aurora kinase B are both subject to drug inhibition. So this is maybe potentially useful information and was published in Nature last year. We want to understand how this relates. And in fact, these mutations change not only the cell cycle, causing them to reproduce out of control, but also mess with the DNA damage repair mechanism, which may bring new mutations into the cancer. So what does this mean? Actually, the final test, if we've really understood what the mutations in the cancer are doing, then they should tell us something about what the prognosis is for the patient or what kinds of treatments will be most effective. And in this case, we cluster the data according to this signature of inferred gene activities, and we find that there's a purple cluster, which on this plot of survival, this is months of survival, shows that there are longer survival in the purple type cancers than in the other ovarian cancers. Statistically significant. So this helps us, would help a doctor do prognosis in this case. And I think some of you, if you are into bioinformatics, you probably have seen this done by microarrays. So this is often, in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of work with microarrays that read gene expression and they make heat maps like this and so forth. We tried this in the other groups, the Broad and WashU tried this with microarrays and it didn't work. So this is more powerful type of information here. Now, I'm going to say a few words about what we can do experimentally with this now. One of the things you want to do is experiment with these cancer cells, try different drugs on them, and see if they work. But you can't experiment in people for obvious reasons. But you can take cancer cells out of a person and grow them in a dish and subject those cells to various drugs. And so this is happening. And there was a lot of concern that cancer cells behave abnormally when they're in a dish. And what you learned from that might be irrelevant to the actual patient. Well, this is encouraging because when we took, in conjunction with Joe Gray's lab, 47 different cancer cell lines that he was growing from breast cancer and compared them with 182 different cancer genome atlas actual cancer tissues from women with breast cancer, and clustered them, the green represent the cell line, and the gold represent the actual tumors. And rather than, as in some previous experiments, rather than see that the cell lines were all clustering in one part together because, you know, the signal we're seeing was cell line versus real, in fact, they're intermingled, and when you cluster them, you actually get distinct types of cancer. In fact, you see known subtypes of breast cancer, like basal breast cancer, clustering together, whether it's from a cell line or from an actual tumor. That suggests that it may be important to pay attention to the information that we get from treating these cell lines with drugs, and which is exactly what we did. So we've looked at different sub-pathways. You can take this larger pathway and divide it. In general, you can take anything, group A and group B, so those cells that respond to a drug, those that don't, or those patients that respond to a drug and those that don't. And you can color code all of the genes in the diagram of interactions according to whether red, let's say, means overactive in group A relative to group B, and blue means underactive. What we get, if you look at this, you get a huge component. Now, the graph of 20,000 genes all talking to each other is a very complicated hairball, But you can zoom in, again, with computer analysis, and you can find parts of it where a whole cluster of genes is overactive or underactive. And we show this then to the breast cancer docs, and they actually recognize a pattern that makes sense to them. For example, this thing called ER are genes that respond to estrogen. This is the estrogen response element. Well, it is known that estrogen plays a very critical role in breast cancer, and lots of the cells in a woman's body that are have gone cancerous and are growing in the breast cancer tumor are responding to estrogen and growing even faster because of that. So this is incredibly important from a clinical point of view. Again, this is not a new discovery, but this now a quantitative way of measuring how much estrogen response has been altered in the tumor. And the other story is similar for these other pathways. So finally, if we can take the cancer data, we can take the raw mutations and interpret them in the context of the actual gene activities within the cell in a way that makes sense, both for prognosis and treatment decisions, then we're in a position to really use genetic information to help with cancer. There's a missing piece on all of this. We've kind of gone in with the paradigm model, and I think there are lots of other ways that you could make that even more realistic. So there's a lot of actual modeling and data analysis to still be done. But even then, once you get to that point, the last stage is we want to come up with the best diagnostic or the best decision procedure built on top of all of the previous layers of analysis. So we are also trying to look at that. We actually run a machine learning package which has support vector machines, neural networks, Bayes classifiers, everything we can throw at this, and we feed it data that is interpretive data or raw data. We do better with interpretive data, and we use the classification, either the patient responded or not, as a training signal, and try to learn better predictors, better classifiers. That's going to be a very important thing, and you'll see a lot of international bake-offs in that area. How well can we predict treatment outcome based on these genetic data? So I think, in summary, where's my summary slide? Whoops, okay, missing the summary slide. In summary, I think there is an enormous opportunity to bring the skills that this community has to bear on A, the big data problem. How can we build the database to actually store the raw cancer genomics information that we need? B, how can we interpret that data just to tell you precisely what are the molecular mutations in the cancer? C, how can we then interpret those mutations as actual changes to gene pathways that matter for the biology? And finally, D, how can we turn that information into actual decisions that will be made in the clinic? All of these are huge challenges, and I hope I've inspired you to think about some of them. Thank you very much. I'll acknowledge a few collaborators here. We have a number of collaborators at the Broad. We work with not only the Stand Up to Cancer, but the Target Project for Childhood Cancer, the Cancer Genome Atlas. Stand Up to Cancer is a ACR founded. We work with the International Cancer Genome Organization and several other organizations. And these are the people whose names you saw on the slides. Thank you. Yeah, questions.
So please line up at the mic for questions. Identify yourself and ask the question so that it can be recorded.
Hi, this is Gina Matthews from Clarkson University. You, one point, talked about a very specific benchmark challenge for this group. Could you repeat what that challenge is and be as specific as you can about what you'd like us to do?
Sorry that it hasn't been released yet, but from CG Hub and from the National Cancer Institute, we will be announcing a Benchmark 4 challenge. It will be called Benchmark 4. The first three have already happened. The challenge will be to read in the mapped raw DNA reads and write out a file that tells us this position was mutated like this, This other position was mutated like this. From a technical point of view, you will be reading in BAM file formats, which are the raw reads, and writing out variant call format or VCF files. So you need to have code that reads BAM and writes VCF.
You said something about prediction. If you can predict what better than everyone else.
Okay, these are other bake-offs. So there is one that's actually going on with the Sage bioinformatics group right now. How can you predict from cancer cell lines whether a drug will be effective or not? And if you look at Sage Bionetworks, S-A-G-E Bionetworks, there's a bake-off going on right now. Unfortunately, there's only a week left in that. But that's one that's going on right now, and we hope to see many more in the future. Another buzzword is DREAM, D-R-E-A-M, DREAM competition. So these are other bake-offs that are happening at this point. Yes?
Hi, Ken Yoakum, Illumina. So I think this is a great talk, and it's a really interesting area. So I wonder if you could comment on consent and actually getting the data into these databases.
Yes.
And about privacy concerns.
Yes.
I think one of the great things about cancer is that people are highly incentivized to actually
Yes.
share their genomic data. But maybe you could comment on how, you know, what are the different ways to get people who maybe don't have life-threatening diseases to get their sequences in
Right.
such a database. Thanks.
Great question. Absolutely great question. The benchmark that we're just about to do release from CG Hub will be on cell lines that are old cancer cell lines. And so those data will be available without any restriction. But the bulk of the data in CG Hub, you have to apply to the Data Access Committee at the NIH to gain access to that data, because these are people's private genome data and they care about the privacy of that. So you have to agree to the privacy rules and you have to demonstrate that you're doing legitimate and interesting research with the data before you will gain access. Now, there is a large social discussion going on right now as to how we should handle this. And there are a spectrum of opinions. On the one hand, if you were watching Colbert on October 4th, you saw George Church and the Personal Genome Project. George is a genius, and the guy is amazing. And he is signing up people who are willing and signed to that effect to share their genome data with the whole world, and their names, and everything about them, all of their medical condition. More power to them, right? The more people that do that, the better. I think that's great. Will we get 1 million people to do that? I don't know. Certainly the NIH won't touch that. They're afraid, they're very litigation averse and social opinion testy, right? And so they're going to go on a much more conservative path of carefully consenting people, controlling the data, not releasing it to anybody but qualified researchers. What should we do as a society? This is a huge decision that you as a society have to make at this point. Yes, cancer patients are highly motivated to share their data, but still there's a feeling that they have to be fully informed about the risks. Could they be denied insurance in the future? The fact that their genome data tells also something about their children's genomes, is that fair without the children's consent? There are all kinds of very difficult issues surrounding this. It's an important area to also get involved in. We make a very strong effort to make some data that's free of any restriction available to you. Unfortunately, that's a small amount of data. Most of the cancer data you will have to apply for access to. Yes?
Amin Vedat, thanks again for the very interesting presentation. I wanted to get to some of the computation and data storage and the costs involved to see if I think this community is in a position to address some of those concerns. So I'll start with MRI. Today costs maybe $1,000, $2,000, and it's a relatively common procedure, maybe more at some
Right.
high-end hospitals. So if we can sequence an individual human genome for $1,000, it seems like we're already in the ballpark for what insurance should be covering, certainly for something as serious as cancer.
That's right.
And now we also have, so if I, again, try to abstract the problem, if I have 100 gigabytes of data, and I need to compare it against, let's say, 100 petabytes of data, right? 1 million people's
That's
genome.
That's right.
I think there are certainly a fair number of companies right now that are doing large-scale data processing on the order of hours for tens of petabytes of data for problems much less important than the ones that you're taking on. And so the cost, yes. I won't in sort of real time try to estimate the cost, but let's say it's also in the thousands of dollars to compare,
yes,
100 gigabytes to 100 petabytes in a day, but as a round number. What is the primary challenge you're seeing? In other words, it seems like today, in terms of cost and available computation power and available storage, we should be able to take on some of these problems.
Right.
Why aren't we, I guess is the question.
Number one reason we aren't doing this today is that we have not made the social contract to collect the data. So it's not, there isn't a million genome database. One of the reasons that we might not be able to do it, even if we had a million genomes right now, is that we still need to understand the data structures and the details behind doing these large-scale comparisons. So there isn't code that's been written, and especially in conjunction with a clever hardware design that would maximize this. Cost will be an obstacle. When you draw the price of DNA sequencing down to $1,000 or below, you want the processing costs to also be below. So there will be an enormous force. If it's a situation where it costs $500 to sequence a genome and $2,000 to analyze it, there will be an enormous pressure to drive that cost down. So you will have to come up with something that is very inexpensive, even though it's using extremely large data. So we are very, very excited about exploring clever indices, ways that we can index the data for very rapid comparison to avoid a simple sequential search through 100 petabytes of data. 100 petabytes of data. I mean, that sounds quite inefficient way of going about this. And I think it's a matter of creativity. I think people have to do this. We concurrently do a complete comparison, matching every piece of DNA to every other piece of DNA for 50 genomes, and it takes a few weeks on our system with the code that we wrote 5 years ago. That clearly has to be completely replaced with something that is much, much more powerful. But it's hard. What can I say?
I guess with the amount of money the NIH is rightfully investing in cancer research, the amount of computation required to address some of these problems in storage is actually, I don't know the exact numbers, but it would be a tiny, tiny fraction
it
of
is.
The NIH research budget. Just an observation more than a question.
Absolutely.
But one other question, since we have a few minutes before getting to the next one. What do you see looking forward happening over the next 3 to 5 years, given recent trends, and if we continue on those paths?
I predict that we will see the NIH invest in extensions of the projects like CG Hub that they have invested in to hold the data from clinical trials. There are 25,000 genomes every year of patients that are actually involved in NIH-sponsored clinical trials. They have some leverage there to say, yeah, we want your genomes, and we want you to put those genomes in a database. So they will probably exert that leverage. I think they're still too timid, and I know because I was at a meeting in Washington 3 weeks ago, they're still a little bit too timid to jump into the 1 million genome database, but we should all rally for it and demand it. I think patient advocates have to stand up and say, demand the data. We want to store our data. We want to learn about this disease. So that's going to be important. The government is skitterish because of the privacy issues as well. And, of course, nothing is going to happen until after the election. But the other thing that I would say is that there are a number of companies that are excited to participate in this. And I would like to encourage that. I would like to see the big companies. So, you know, you could ask, where is Google in this? Where is Amazon? Are you standing up? Are you gonna contribute? I challenge everybody to. Illumina, where's Illumina? Illumina's a sequencing company. Stand up and contribute to this. I think it's great. And the more competition we get, the better for this. Finally, I would challenge the philanthropists. If any of you know somebody who wants to make an impact with the money that they have at this point, really, really change the world for better, this is the place to put your $50 or $100 million right now. Create a big initiative. That would be a game changer, and I'm hoping that we will see that in the next couple of years. And all of these three things can happen together. Interestingly enough, there was a consortium called the Single Nucleotide Polymorphism, or SNP Consortium, in 2003, when we first wanted to document all of the differences that occur between people. And they had companies and the government all contributing to an international collaboration, and the data was free and open, and everybody built software on it. And now we have the Thousand Genomes Project, which is analyzing and building more data on that. This is important. So there are precedents for joint funding and open-ended stuff. Yes?
Brian Ford, Yale University. Very nice, very interesting talk. Thank you. I wanted to ask a question related to Amin, to one of Amin's actually. Are you able to characterize maybe a little bit more specifically what the major computational, you know, storage and processing roadblocks you most or just bottlenecks you run into, you know, when you say you already, you know what you want to do, you know, in a particular case, but we don't have enough X, you know, we don't have enough I/O bandwidth, parallelism,
yes,
you know, enough, you know, we have enough disk in this
right
case, but we run out of memory. Memory is too expensive to make this particular type of.
What
are the most
great question,
you know, the biggest kind of technical roadblocks?
If we take the bioinformatics genome analysis programs that exist today, the best we can get from Galaxy or any of the bioinformatics groups around the world that have written software to analyze genomes today, and we try to run them at scale, the number one roadblock is I/O. Absolutely. The number one, we find this, it's just way too inefficient. They're written as all isolated tools. Every bioinformaticist sits down and says, okay, I'm going to write a tool. It reads in this file. It does this little thing, and it writes out another file. And then I'll use Fred's tool, and it'll read in the file, and it'll write out another file. And then I'll use Jill's tool, and so forth. We got 100 petabytes of data, gang, here. That shit doesn't work, okay? So there's a whole rewrite of the way we think about this analysis that has to be done. We need stuff where efficiency is part of the game from the beginning. And I don't want to cast aspersions on the bioinformatics. They're all clever and they're doing heavy research and so forth, but they're not big data software engineers for the most part. The marriage between the big data people and the bioinformaticians is yet to come. It's just happening now. So there's a big mismatch. So I mean, there are other answers to that, but I'll tell you, number one, the bugs the hell out of me, it's the goddamn I/O.
Perfect, thanks.
Okay.